Accession number 32137, reel 1.
If you could say your name and your date of birth.
Well, my name is John Jenkins, and my date of birth is 18th of May 1916.
And where were you born?
In Dover.
So, can you tell me, first of all, how old you were when you decided to join the army?
Yes, I was 22, actually. I joined because I had been in the territorials. I joined the TA when I was about 18 in Dover, and that was a searchlight company of Royal Engineers. And my father had been in the Royal Engineers, so that was what I wanted to do. And that was at Brompton, Gillingham.
And can you, you mentioned the searchlight job. Can you explain what that was? Because that sounds interesting.
Well, it was a searchlight company in Dover, and there were searchlights permanently in several different places, and our job was to man them, and the gunners, what they did, they had a tug pulling a derelict ship, and the gunners had to fire at this, and we had to provide the searchlight so that they could see them. And well, they had two or three places in Dover that we used to go to and start up the engine and turn on the searchlights. They're good, actually. You just two carbon things came together like that, and you've got a terrific spark. And that's how you got the light.
We're talking about 1938 when you properly joined up as a young man. Looking back on history, obviously it was a time of terrible international tension in Europe.
It was.
Were you aware of that? Was that part of your decision?
Well, at that age, you know, I wasn't. I was aware that there was tension in the world, but I didn't realise how bad it was. You know, because we did our training. As a matter of fact, I did my training in Canterbury because. At Chatham, it was already a bit overflowing with troops, and then I was made a lance corporal, and then I went back to Chatham on a cadre course, and that's when the I can't forget his name. What was the
Chamberlain?
When he came back, soon after that, I was posted to Ripon, where my former commanding officer was in charge of the training battalion, and I had, well, from Ripon, I was then sent to Octu to do my officer training.
And what were your various stages of training like? Were they enjoyable?
Best part of engineer training was what they call field works, and that was building bridges, and we were still digging trenches then, just like the First World War, and lining them, you know. One of the tasks as a recruit was to dig, you had 2 hours to dig a trench 6 feet deep, you know, enough to stand up in, and the next chapter you did the same, and in the end you had a whole length of trench to dig. We had what they called a small box girder and a large box girder. And obviously we learnt how to launch them and get the traffic going across them, all that sort of thing.
You obviously decided to go for the officer training. Why was that?
A friend of mine that I'd joined up with originally, he said, well, I'm going to have a go at getting a commission. And he got one he went to Octu, it was just the same. And so that sort of spurred me to do the same. And we had 6 months there from, I think that was from October 1940 to April 1941. And that was during the Blitz on London, and we could see it from Aldershot. You know, you could see the glow in the sky. It really was terrific, and you could hear it rumbling in the distance. I mean, Aldershot's a fair distance away from London. And I saw one or two places where they dropped a few bombs on Aldershot. And there was a whole house. The whole house was, the front of it was down, and you could see all the room, rather like I told you, in Germany too. And I remember one of my colleagues was a great pianist, an organ player, and there was an organ in this house. You could see it. And so we crept in and he played a tune on me. Oh dear. The typical, isn't it?
Yeah. Young men.
Yeah.
No sort of reverence for what just happened. And what was your attitude to the enemy at this stage?
Well, I don't know. I just that they were an enemy and we got to fight them. That was all. I mean, I didn't hate them or anything like that. You got rather more resentful when you heard of what happened later on, you know, the Holocaust and all that. But at the time, and particularly when I got into North Africa, now that was marvellous because that was no civilians were involved. It was a matter of tactics. And it was either the German tactics or the British tactics, the Italians, they were hopeless. They gave up as soon as we got to them, more or less.
So, anyway, you're at Aldershot. Presumably you finished your training. What happened next?
I knew that I was going abroad somewhere. And in fact, I finished up in India. We left from Gourock and went with the usual Atlantic convoys, and we had some rather marvellous. The Renown was one of our escort ships that was sunk a few months later. Lots of people killed on that, and we went. We stopped first of all at Sierra Leone on the west coast of Africa. We didn't get off the ship there, but we had a break there, and then we went round and we had 3 days shore leave in Cape Town.
What was that like?
No, that was lovely, and the people were marvellous. And of course they didn't know there was a war on. Lovely food and everything else. Yeah, that was great.
Must have been like paradise.
Yeah, it was. You're quite right. It was. It was really lovely, and the people were so friendly. You know, looked after us all. But apparently that was happening all the time. You see, most of the ships that were going to the east stopped at Cape Town.
And what were you doing? Because these very long voyages between stops. What did you do on the ship?
Mostly it. It was originally one of the cruise ships, and it was all stocked up, ready to cruise somewhere when the war started. So we were very lucky because we used to have a sort of seven course breakfast, that sort of thing. But we did a certain amount of running around the ship and exercise, and they had a small swimming pool there because I was mad keen on swimming. I used to be a very good swimmer, actually, and so that I did get some exercise. I quite enjoyed the trip out, except for the convoy, because you didn't know what was going to happen, you know. And we used to zigzag all the way across it, you know, wherever we were going, it was a zigzag. You never went straight. And that was because, if happened to be a U-boat about, the torpedo would miss you if you'd gone on the right jig.
And did you ever witness any enemy at all?
No.
And during this voyage, did you know what your end destination was going to be?
All I knew was that we were going out far east, and that was it. But and then when we docked at Mumbai, or Bombay as it was then, and there was a colonel on the shore, and he organised us to go up to the Kirki or Pune, and that was where our headquarters, Royal Engineers headquarters were.
So that, again, another amazing impression to absorb at that young age.
Yeah.
Again.
But it's funny how you sort of took it for granted somehow, I don't know. And of course, Indian then, of course, it was all as it used to be. The Raj and everything was, and we were treated like princes, I suppose. You know, we were the bosses. It didn't matter what we could do anything we liked. Not that we did, but you know that was the sort of feeling you had.
So, what did you actually do then in Pune? What was your job?
Well, the main object of going there was to learn Urdu and to try and get used to the Indian troops, because I had not been with Indian troops at all before. So we had a Munshi, that's a teacher. He was an Indian, not bad. I wouldn't say that I learnt very much Urdu, quite honestly, because I was there for 3 months, actually. But I did have some contact with the troops, you know. I had to do exercises and things with them, and I had to make myself known to them and tell them what to do. Well, it was a mixture of me and one of the Jemadar, that's a Indian officer, not a English officer. He spoke a bit of English, so between us we managed to do all that. I got out there in July, and in October again, I think it was, I was posted to the Middle East, because that's where the 4th Indian Division was.
What was the name of the unit you were with in Pune?
Oh, well, that was the Royal Bombay Sappers and Miners. That was the unit.
That was the unit.
And I was posted to the Middle East 18 Field Company, Royal Bombay Sappers and Miners. And we had different uniforms from the British troops. Well, it was a sort of grey top, and, well, I think the shorts were just khaki shorts, and you had a thing on your shoulder. They had, the 4th Indian Division had they called it, pardon my French, a shite hawk. It was a red kite hawk. That was the main bird in Egypt. It was called a kite hawk, but it, of course the troops had different names, as always.
So you got back on a ship and headed for the Middle East with the Indian troops.
Pardon?
With the Indian troops.
No, I was posted with three other officers, all second lieutenant, you know, had just been trained, and we were just posted as a group of officers. That's all, it wasn't until we got to Cairo that we knew which unit we were going to.
And how about Cairo? What was that like?
I didn't see much of that, because the officers' reception area was just outside Cairo. Do you know Egypt at all? Well, there was a big hotel there, I think it's still there, called Mina House, and that had been taken over by the army to as an officers' training area, or transit area rather. And I was there for only 2 days, and then went up in a convoy up through the desert to... we were still in Egypt then. We hadn't gone across into Libya I think it was a place called Saloum. And that's where my unit was.
So that's where you joined your unit that you were going to be serving.
That's right,
with. And so when did you start to move, and why?
They used to call the battles in the Middle East the Benghazi Stakes, because when we went forward, we got up as far as Benghazi and ran out of petrol and stores, because it was such a long way, and so we had to come back. And by that time the Germans had also recouped, because they'd gone back, because we'd pushed them back, and they'd recouped, come forward, and they pushed us back. We were in the second one. That was in November 1941.
And what was it like?
Well, I don't know. It's a bit odd, really. The trouble is, I felt that I didn't really know enough. You know, I wasn't told enough, other than giving me a compass point and saying, well, you've got to be there by so-and-so. And I was usually there. There was no problem there at all. But
so you
we
were
did,
driving on the road?
Well, we're not on the road, on the desert. And you had to spread out to avoid being bombed, or, you know, if they did bomb us, they'd only hit one vehicle instead of a whole lot. We went right across the desert, like the tanks and the lorries and everything else.
Describe a little bit of your everyday work when you were going back up towards Benghazi.
Well, a lot of it was, well, before we did that, there was a lot of training of the troops, and you had night training, and you also had day training, and a lot of that was done with a sun compress. Now that, well, it was just like a compass you have in the garden.
Like a sundial.
Sun compass. You had it on, because the sun was good there, you had it on the front of the vehicle.
So the idea was that wherever you were in the desert, you could find
that's
where
right.
You're supposed to be going.
Yeah, and I used to, well, what we had to do, I sent part of my troops to one section, a part to another, and then all met somewhere else. That worked all right, actually. And I think part of the training, obviously, was getting used to the men and being able to talk to them, and they got to know me as well. And again, I had a Jemadar who was a... his English was quite reasonable, you know. We managed to, between us, my poor Urdu and his better English, we managed to do what was necessary. And we also made all sorts of things, you know, to blow up mines, all that sort of thing. To blow up mines, you know, so you could get through, we threaded through gelignite in a sort of sausage. And threaded it through the minefield, blew it up, so all the mines on either side were blown up. There was a clear passage then for the tanks to go through and other vehicles. Another job was what we called digging in the gunners. We had one of our vehicles was a compressor, you know, with tools and everything, and it was very rocky there, and the gunners had to try and get down below the surface. And that was another job that we had to do. That was really hard work too, not for me, but you know, to get the surface clear enough for them to get their guns down in it. In Libya, there were things called biers, B-I-R. Now a bier was a sort of hillock, and on most of them, underneath, they dug out the earth, formed this sort of hill, and in the hollow under the earth, there was some water. Pretty awful water, I must say. And one of the jobs we did was to pump this out into our... We had special tanks for water. They were canvas, you know, that expanded when you put water in it. And pump it out and do a purification process, you know, chlorinated it and put some, I think... Beginning with A, I've forgotten what it is, which made all the any rubbish go down to the bottom, and then you put the chlorine or chlorinated it. Well, we did that. It wasn't great success, but because not many people came by and wanted the water, so. But that was.
But it was there.
Yeah, that was the sort of thing. You said you wanted to know what
yes,
we did.
Yeah. And were you? A lot of the time, were you ahead of the fighting troops? I mean, was it quite dangerous?
No. We were usually with them. You had to go ahead if there was a minefield to clear a passage for them. That was all. But normally, we were up with them or just behind. You know, that was the tanks really had to get up there and sort the enemy out so that our infantry could go in and do the final bits and pieces.
So were you often there on the battlefield then? I mean, were you having incoming fire?
Yeah. An example, they were called lagers, and that's where the Germans had them, we had them. The whole unit was in a great big compound, as it were, and we did all the mines and things to protect us all the way around. And on one occasion, we were all there, and... The Germans had come. There was a ridge. You could see it from there. It must have been about a mile away. A ridge, and the German tanks were just coming over that, and all our guns were. I mean, we had some heavy guns as well as light gun, and they were all instructed not to fire until they were given the order. And the German tanks gradually came over, and they were firing, but it was such a long way. There were armour-piercing bullets bouncing on the ground, but, you know, they almost spent because they were too far away. Anyway, when the order was given to fire. They knocked out about five German tanks straight away because everything went at them. You never saw anything like it. And the noise, I mean, nothing like Al Alamein, but it was loud enough. Yeah.
And that was it, that advance.
Yeah, well, then the Germans decided that wasn't good. They all went back. We didn't see them again after that.
So you kept pushing up, and did you get as far as up to Benghazi?
Yeah, we did. Yeah, that was it.
What was that like?
Well, I wasn't there very long. I'll tell you another thing we did. When a place called Derna, which was one of the towns, it was a sort of desert village, I suppose. Anyway, there was a certain amount of civilization there, because as you also know, the Italians had occupied Libya, and they had done quite a lot of work there, you know, building roads and bridges and all sorts of things. At Derna, there was an aerodrome, and on the aerodrome, they were repairing aircraft, and there must have been 8 dive bombers all up ready to, you know, to be repaired, and we blew the whole lot up, you know, put some gelignite in the engine, set it on fire. So that was pretty good. I was very pleased with that, putting out all those aircraft out of action, because we were bombed all the way. You know, the dive bombers came and dropped things on us, and there was one occasion when we shot down a German aircraft. The pilot managed to get out, and he opened his parachute, and it caught in the flames on the plane. And so he just dropped like a stone, actually. Terrible, that was. But
we got used to seeing things like that.
Well, I know that's a well, it got much worse than that later on in Egypt, in Germany, in France. But, now what was our day? Oh, we got to Derna, yeah. And then we also got it. Well, the object of this exercise, as I told you, was to relieve the Australians in Tobruk, which we did. And the Australians, most of them went home, actually. They'd done their stint in the Middle East, and we still had, the South African army took over from the Australian. And we also had some New Zealanders there, Free French, Poles, you know, quite a mixture of troops there.
What did you do up in Tobruk then?
Not very much. You see, again, Tobruk was surrounded by a fantastic minefield all the way round, and all we did was try to make sure that it all worked still, you know, that because there are a lot of anti-personnel mines in the beds around there. It was a bit tricky, actually, because, in fact, he was an Indian officer, actually, I think he was a medical man. He went where he shouldn't have been going. He blew half his face off. It was absolutely terrible. And he was lying there, and they called us to, because they didn't want to go into the minefield themselves, they called us. And I actually saw why he had been blown up. Because we used to put it was a little 2-kilogram mine, and you put a fuse in the top with a it was a sharp pin. Now, if you trod on it, it set the whole thing off. And that's what he'd done. And there was one on the path where he, and I saw it, luckily, and managed to take it out. And that was awful. You know, he was stiff as a bull. We had to lug him out.
Had he been there for a while, then, by the time
I suppose he must have, well, at least he got gone into rigor mortis anyway, so it was pretty awful. Well, that's what we were doing, sort of repairing the minefield around. And then after a while, wait a minute. Yeah, we did that, and then we went forward again. I've forgotten exactly why, but we went forward again, and that was when we went to Benghazi, and then it was decided we'd have to go back because of the lack of supplies and difficult, such a long way to bring it, you see.
And so you triumphed. You got to your goal.
Yeah.
But then the Germans were pushing back again.
The Germans had recouped and were ready for action again, and we weren't. So we went back, and on the way back, I had the job of blowing up. There was a pass that came up from near the shore and came up to the top of the desert. Very narrow, actually, it was. And I had the job of blowing a great big hole in it so that the Germans couldn't get any troops. And that's what I did. Obviously, it was repaired later on. But it was very narrow. All the approaches from the top to the bottom were around the edges of the cliffs, you know, and rock. And then, having done that, we travelled nearly all night. So I don't know who the leader was, but practically the whole brigade, that's quite a few troops and vehicles, were travelling at night to get back to our own lines.
You'd planted all those mines up there to protect your various areas. Did you just left them there?
We're supposed to be, the whole thing was supposed to be properly protected. But in fact, it wasn't, as we realised in the end, but at least the Germans managed to find their way through it. They didn't manage to when the Australians were there. But I think that was because the Australians seemed to be more alert than the South Africans. Because the South Africans were the main troops in Tobruk when it fell. I mean, I may be maligning them, but that's the impression I got. You know, I don't know it, because it happened so quickly. Anyway, we haven't got there yet.
So you're now retreating overnight.
Yep.
Down again. Just get the orders and.
That's right.
And did you have lots of stuff to pack up and everything? It can't have been that easy to move.
Not really. I mean, we didn't have much stuff. I had a vehicle of my own, and I had a tent in it, you know, that I could put up, and my bed, a folding bed thing, and a mattress and stuff. And it absolutely filthy it was. It never hadn't been washed for months. But anyway, we were all right from that point of view. The food was pretty awful because, there wasn't very much, you know. You just had to eat what you could. And it was mostly the terribly hard biscuits. Even I was an officer, and all I could get was a blooming hard biscuit and a tin of bully beef, just the same as anybody else, really.
So where did you go to eat? Did you eat on the job there, or were there sort of canteen tents?
Well, when we stopped anywhere, they usually erected the officer's mess tent. I don't know, I managed to do it, and we had some food in there, actually. That wasn't bad. I mean, nothing special, but at least it was food. And then we went on, and eventually, as I told you, we went back to the Cairo, the canal zone, you know, around there.
And that was the end of North Africa for you, or...?
No, that was the end of the first campaign.
Okay.
And we went back, really, so that we could have some rest, because we'd been moving nearly all the time, to-ing and fro-ing.
Over what sort of period was the to-ing and fro-ing,
Well, I was in Cairo in April. I suppose we had about a month altogether, so we must have gone there, you know, early in 1942, early in the year. Went there, had a rest to recoup and get all our stuff in order again, because, you know, we obviously used a lot of it in the battles. And I don't know. Well, that was it, really. Once we got all these, and we had quite a lot of new vehicles too, because some of ours had been blown up or damaged or fallen by the wayside. And we were then, eventually went up into Tobruk again.